Well, I think the time has come to begin the session. I'm not Jess Grosbeck, as you can tell, so I put this little sign up so that you know that and you can be reminded. Jess had a medical problem. He has some same-day surgery coming up and was unable to be here. We have been in touch with him by phone, and he emailed me his paper after extensive revisions and talking to him on the phone. We arrived at a final paper, which I hope you'll enjoy. I was fascinated by a lot of the material that he had gathered. I was going to respond to his paper anyway, but since I was reading the paper, I thought, that's going to be a trick. I'm going to read the paper, respond, and answer questions and answers. And I thought, that's a little much. But I was talking to Toby, who is also a good friend of Jess's, and he offered to respond to it. So I really appreciate him doing that. So I'll go ahead and read the paper. The handouts are kind of self-explanatory as I go through each one of those five women. You can see what that chart means. It's a little bit unclear probably right at the first, but it'll become clear as we discuss these exemplary women. And that's unfortunate. I'm sorry. I've turned it off in all the other sessions except my own. Okay, he begins by saying, I would like to dedicate this paper to the marvelous women in my life who have been such great inspirations. My mother, my grandmothers, my dear wife, Sharon, who has passed on, and my current and wonderful wife, Sylvia. There are many others I could cite, but these are women who have been my examples and who have given me guidance, spirituality, direction, and a reason to love life. It's very obvious that there are many stories and accounts about men's development in Mormonism, but considerably fewer about women. Thus, it is the purpose of this paper to outline a five-fold path for Mormon women set in the backdrop of Mormon history, teachings, and culture. This research is a result of many years of work with individual Mormon women in analytical psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, along with personal experiences with the many wonderful women in my life. The primary objective is to focus on love relationships for a woman with her husband and children. Five initiation stages for a Mormon woman will be described, and each one illustrated with a famous woman in scriptural history. And the ones are listed on your paper: Eve, the mother of all living; Sarah, Abraham's wife; Mary, the mother of Jesus; Mary Magdalene, a close associate, and many believe the wife of Joseph, of Jesus Christ; and Zion, the mother in heaven. I had heard that term used, as you probably have, in many ways, but not as referring to the mother in heaven. But he does give some examples and some scriptural references. Well, maybe not scriptural references, but references from early leaders where that could be a possibility. Keep in mind, this is Jess's perspective. I've agreed with most of it, but that's why I put this sign up. I may not agree with every single thing in it. I've known Jess since I was practically a teenager, and we have been good friends. In fact, he is my brother-in-law. And we agree on a lot of things about the gospel, but there are a few differences, just like there are with a lot of people. Initiation rites of passage have occurred throughout all time, history, and cultures, and are part of a necessary process for human beings to pass through in their development stages of life: birth, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, old age, and death. Initiation rituals are especially important in preparing for marriage and a career, in the important decisions that we make in life. It is psychologically very difficult and traumatic for an individual to go from one of these stages to another without the help of these initiation rites. This has been determined by many researchers who have given us a knowledge about initiation, such as Arnold Van Gennep. He described a three-stage process. One lives in a particular developmental state. The stability of that state, if it is disrupted, it challenges and could destroy the security of that state. Two, a time of chaos occurs, and the individual loses his identity and connection with that original state. They are neither what they were before or what they will become in the future. During this difficult time, there is much uncertainty and confusion and doubt. And the third stage that this particular researcher mentions is a time of reorganization. So the individual can move ahead in the initiation process and is enabled to enter the next stage of development. A simple example of this would be a single man or a woman who is preparing to get married. The first stage then would be they live in a single life with certain rules, regulations pertaining to the way their life is lived in terms of food and clothing and time allotments and things like that. And then the second step would be as they make a commitment to get married, they then move to the second stage of chaos and disorganization as they prepare for living with somebody else, for a close commitment with another person. The third one would be then after the marriage ordinance or ritual takes place, they learn to share more closely their time, space, finances, and attention with another person. A new identity as a marriage partner is established. So I think it's important to kind of set the foundation for these initiatory stages that Jess is going to mention later, that we all in our life, looking back, have gone through different stages, and it has been very helpful to have time to prepare for each change of the stages. Researchers have found that it is very difficult for individuals to make these changes unless certain initiation rituals take place. This paper will present the thesis that there is a 5-stage process for Mormon women in the initiation rites of gaining exaltation in the celestial kingdom. So this does focus on women, but it can apply to men in many cases as well. It is assumed that those listening to this paper will understand the theological concepts in Mormonism in which exaltation in the celestial kingdom is the ultimate goal of all worthy Mormons as they seek the highest spiritual achievement. However, this discussion will not pretend to focus only on doctrinal issues, but to focus on psychological issues as well in the psycho-spiritual development of a Mormon woman as she goes along the path to achieve that goal. This goal will be described in the writer's perspective as that of individuation, as C.J. Jung and Murray Bauman in their psychological works. In individuation, it is meant that a woman lives out her life so that she may realize all the potential for which she was born. Or, as Murray Bauman stated, quote, she will be able to differentiate herself to the highest levels of individual and self-understanding and development that is conceivable for her, end of quote. It is a writer's view that in Mormonism, this initiatory pathway is defined by the theology and scriptural understanding of Mormonism as it has been presented by its founders, especially Joseph Smith. The writer is not pretending to define any particular doctrinal stance or position, but only to utilize Mormon doctrinal teachings in a psychological, spiritual way to define this 5-stage initiatory process. This will be carried out by utilizing a method of amplification of these major stages that Jung outlined in his works, in which he defined archetypal patterns as the basis of human life and its development. Archetypal patterns are inborn potential patterns of inheritance that individuals come to experience in their lives as a guide by which to move ahead in their development. As mentioned, 5 famous and significant women in Mormon theological and scriptural history have been selected to illustrate these archetypal pathways that a woman must travel in her quest for goddesshood. The focus will be on 2 key love relationships, first her husband and second her children. The pathway will follow a sequence of living for one's spouse and children, being willing to die for them, and finally letting her spouse and children go when they get to a certain point so they can go on their own particular path. Edward Tullidge paints a classic picture of the Mormon woman in his book Women of Mormondom. And if you haven't read that book, I highly recommend it. He mentions that the origin of a Mormon woman's identity begins before this earth life. In fact, as Job says, the woman was, quote, one of the morning stars who shouted for joy, end of quote. Thus, Mormon woman's origin began among the gods and goddesses. the biblical perception that women began when Eve was created from the rib of Adam is not the Mormon position. Like I said, it began before that time. From Joseph Smith's revelations, we learn that Eve had existed long before, and with her came a new definition of women and her place among gods. She helped lay the foundations of the earth. The sisters in early Mormonism were seen as part of an eternal chain of creations coming down from the generations of the gods, most likely, as defined by Joseph Smith, but more expressly by Brigham Young. Adam was a great archangel of creation. He was Michael, the Ancient of Days, the father of the spirits and tabernacles of all sons and daughters of man on this earth. Michael was one of the grand mystical names in the works of creation. Brigham Young stated that Michael was a celestial resurrected being from another world. In the likeness of fathers and mothers, the gods created man, male and female, he created them. When Michael or Adam came down to this earth, he brought with him one of his wives. You'll probably, if you've investigated the Adam-God doctrine at all, you'll see elements of that doctrine in this paragraph. Eve was not taken from a rib or Adam from a lump of clay, but she was brought by Adam to earth to be the mother of all living. Adam and Eve had lived in another world and now, exalted, came down to provide their own children with tabernacles for their spirits. Coolidge also describes this fall into mortality. Quote, "They came on purpose to fall. They fell that man might be, and man is that he might have joy. They ate of the tree of mortal life, partook of the elements of this earth, that they might again become mortal for their children's sake. They fell that another world might have a probation, redemption, and resurrection." End quote. The central identity of woman is best illustrated by Eliza R. Snow in her very famous and well-known hymn, O My Father. The original title of that song was Invocation, or The Eternal Father and Mother. In that hymn, the last part of the song reads, "In the heavens are parents single, no, the thought makes reason stare. Truth is reason, truth eternal tells me I've a mother there. When I leave this frail existence, when I lay this mortal by, Father, Mother, may I greet you in your royal courts on high. Then at length, when I've completed all you sent me forth to do, when you're with your mutual approbation, may I come and dwell with you." Thus, the Mormon woman learns where she came from and where she can return. So, starting now with each of these five women, he says, so what can the Mormon woman learn about her own rites of initiation from these five exemplary archetypes? Beginning with Eve. In the Garden of Eden, Eve ate of the forbidden fruit and asked Adam to partake also. Initially, he refused, but realizing that this was the only way the two of them could stay together, he relented. Genesis 3 and 16 records the result. Quote, "Unto the woman, he, the Lord, said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee." Eve then was to hearken to the counsel of her husband, as her husband was to hearken to the counsel of the father. Thus Eve sacrificed herself in mortality and took the first step in the love relationship by subjecting her desires to those of her husband. Secondly, she was told that in sorrow she would have children, but that it would be a means of salvation for her, and she would be saved in childbearing. This illustrates a very important point, that pregnancy is one of the most difficult of all experiences in human life. Many women even die in pregnancy or giving childbirth. In a sense, then, a woman was to be willing to die for her children. As a result of Eve's actions in the Garden of Eden, today a Mormon woman married to a Mormon patriarch is told that she should subject herself to her husband and his direction. He, however, must direct in righteousness, for the woman has no obligation to follow him. And this goes on about the feminist part. This concept, of course, has been challenged by many people, particularly in recent years of the feminist movement. That is basically a belief that I have, is that because of the way the heavens are set up, because of the Adam and Eve situation, and she was told that she had to follow her husband's direction, that is something that I think has carried over into Mormonism and to fundamentalist Mormonism as well. We believe in a patriarchal society. But I also believe that a lot of that depends on the man. And if he is a righteous husband and father, the amount or the issue of who rules over who, it just becomes kind of a moot point. That I was very lucky to be married to a husband that we were just kind of considered each other's equals. And I think in this day and age, that is the tendency in a lot of marriages, hopefully, that they consider each other more as equals in many ways. But this was according to the paper that because of the fall of Adam and Eve, that was the seniority arrangement. But for practical purposes for this paper, this is the first test of a Mormon marriage, whether or not a woman can live harmoniously with her husband so that this initiation step can be fully completed. And then in each one of these, at the conclusion of each woman that he talks about, he goes into the psychological application. For many women, these two steps are very difficult. To commit her desires to her husband is the first part, and two, to potentially die for her children in childbirth. There are many problems that can arise along the way. What if a husband is unfaithful or negligent in supporting her? What if he dies and she is left alone to carry the whole burden of the family? Even with a good husband, many women feel burdened because of the seriousness of the commitment and sacrifice they are expected to make to complete this first initiatory step. Now going on to Sarah, Abraham's wife, she illustrates the second stage of initiation for the Mormon woman and her pathway to goddesshood. Her situation was the opposite of Eve's. She died for her husband and lived for her children. To explain, even though Sarah was old and beyond normal childbearing years, her husband had been promised by the Lord that he would have endless posterity. And so, in her effort to fulfill that blessing for him and for herself, since she had not been able to conceive, she gave Abraham her handmaid Hagar to be a wife. Thus, in a sense, she died for her husband, giving up the exclusive right to him. It was a difficult struggle for Sarah to do that. With Hagar, Abraham had Ishmael. Because of Sarah's sacrifice and of being willing to die, in a sense, for her husband, she was given the blessing that she would live for her children. She was given the miracle of birth and had Isaac, who became a great soul. But Isaac and Ishmael had problems, and Hagar and Ishmael were sent away from their home for a time. God nevertheless promised Sarah that she would be a mother of nations, quote, kings of people shall be of her. That's in Genesis. She, in a sense, became the mother of generations. From her lineage came the Israelite and Jewish nations, and from Ishmael came the Arab and Mohammedan nations, totaling hundreds of millions of people. Thus, Sarah became a mother to an endless posterity. Psychological application of this is these initiatory rites of plural marriage, where a woman gives her husband another wife, is a great and difficult sacrifice. In other parts of the world where this practice is accepted, it is also a great trial, but perhaps not as great as it has been among the Mormon people. Joseph Smith stated that the greatest of all blessings for those involved can come from living this principle, which he called the most holy principle. Now Mary, the mother of Jesus, represents the third initiatory stage, which a woman must go through on her journey to goddesshood. In this stage, she must be willing to give up her husband and offspring and let them go their own way, on their own path. In this regard, motherhood is especially difficult because it requires giving up those people in whom she has invested much of her adult life. She has to be willing to let them go. In the case of Mary, the mother of Jesus, she was a unique individual. She was chosen of God to be the mother of the Savior of the world, but she also had an interesting relationship with her husband Joseph, who sustained her and undoubtedly gave her other children. Although married to Joseph in mortality, the scriptures seem to indicate that he was not the literal father of Jesus, and that Jesus was conceived through the power of the Holy Ghost. According to Brigham Young, quote, "When the Virgin Mary conceived the child Jesus, the Father had begotten him in his own likeness. He was not begotten by the Holy Ghost." End of quote. Further information about Mary's marital relationships is provided by Sarah Granger Kimball. counselor in the Relief Society of the General Presidency. She recorded on December 27, 1886, quote, that the Prophet Joseph Smith told her brother and a bishop that, quote, when Mary, the mother of Jesus, was on her way to the hill country, she was met by God, the Father, and the angel Gabriel, and the latter performed the marriage between the Father and Mary. That might be a new concept for some of you. I don't believe I'd heard of it before. But I thought that was interesting. So now she has a marriage with God the Father, and then she later on will be married for this life to Joseph. Thus Mary had a spiritual husband in heaven, God the Father, whose association she literally had to give up in mortality. Most likely she was cut off from both husbands to some degree. One she had to give up in mortality, and the other for eternity. So in a way, she had to become a woman unto herself. Secondly, she had to sacrifice and give up her son, Jesus, by letting him grow and become the person he was meant to be, and eventually to be crucified for the sins of the world. So Mary gave up both husband and son. Even though she was married and committed to her husband or husbands, she was still an independent being, living in great power, authority, and presence. She attained the status of a truly independent woman, not being in any secondary state to a mortal man. With her connection to the God of heaven, she had an even higher status. This implies, in a sense, a divine polyandry. And I'm not going to go into detail on that because we've had some sessions where that got into a pretty heated discussion. But it is interesting to consider that this might have been a possibility then. Mary had two husbands, God our Father in heaven, as well as Joseph, the carpenter. However, she apparently was sealed for eternity to only one of them. The psychological application of this: of course, there is no other woman on this earth who is going to have a Christ child as did the Virgin Mary. But most women are going to have children, many of whom will have to go through great struggles and sacrifices, and she will have to be willing at some point to give them up and let them live their own lives. Many times, a woman hinders her own progression by vicariously living through her children, thus preventing their progression as well as her own. Secondly, she may have to live a more independent life, away from an earthly husband. Many women who have lived or now live a law of patriarchal plural marriage have had to live that way. This was described by Zina Dianthus Young, who stated that a woman in plural marriage had, quote, had to be able to live independently and not fall into jealousy of other wives in wanting one's husband too exclusively, end of quote. My great-grandmothers, Cornelia and Rhoda Grosbeck, lived far apart with only infrequent visits from their husband. They learned to live very independently. Mary Magdalene, we have now traced three of the stages in the initiation process for a woman. Eve, who lived for her husband and died in pregnancy and childbirth for her children. Sarah, who died for her husband by giving him another wife, and lived for, this is kind of figurative, and lived for her children and her posterity. And then Mary, the mother of Jesus, who gave up her eternal husband in this life and her son to his mission and crucifixion. So what stage in the initiation process does Mary Magdalene represent? She represents the culmination of the development of a woman, that initiatory phase in which a true hieros gamos, or sacred and divine marriage, takes place with her husband, assuming that he too has progressed along the same pathway of divinity to become a god. In fact, she is now capable of becoming a goddess if he is capable of becoming a god. Then they are joined together and are married in every sense of the word through the hieros gamos. And what is this hieros gamos? And I might not be pronouncing that right. Is that about right? It's just a psychological term, but I've heard it in other areas as well. From the beginning of time, the sacred marriage was intended to increase cultures in places and times. For example, the marriage of a king and a queen. It was to be the ideal marriage, the ideal union in body and spirit and soul of the king and queen. This is a time when a woman can be totally committed to both her husband and to herself without reservation. She is treated as a queen of heaven, as a queen and a priestess unto her husband and to God. The commitment is to be total and unconditional. It will not be destructive to either party, as they both will achieve their fullest opportunity for individuation, the fullest realization of their divine selves. This is best recognized and articulated in what is known as the second anointing in Mormon theology, in which a man and woman are ordained as a king and queen and a king and priest, and a queen and a priestess, in preparation for having endless spiritual offspring. Mary Magdalene was the manifestation of this while still in mortal life, preparing for the transition of death and initiation into the next life. It is assumed that she was married to Jesus in a divine relationship and was given the privilege of being the first to greet him in the morning of the first resurrection. Other wives may also have been involved, but she was the first. The attainment of this highest order of exaltation in the celestial kingdom is described in D&C 132, verses 19 to 21, part of which reads as follows, quote, "And again, verily I say unto you, if a man marry a wife by my word, which is my law, and by the new and everlasting covenant, and it is sealed in them by the Holy Spirit of promise, by him who is anointed, unto whom I have appointed this power and keys of the priesthood, and it shall be said unto them, he shall come forth in the first resurrection, then shall it be written in the Lamb's book of life, they shall pass by the angels and the gods, which are set there to their exaltation and glory in all things, as hath been sealed upon their heads, which glory shall be a fullness and continuation of the seeds forever and ever. Then they shall be gods, because they have no end. Therefore they shall be from everlasting to everlasting." In this remarkable promise, it appears that this is the highest level of sacred marriage in Mormon theology. The psychological application of this is there are many examples of people who have attained this level of development in their marriage, where a true sealing takes place. And what is that sealing? While that term is used in a legalistic way and performed by an authorized administrator as an ordinance, it has an even more profound meaning as described by E. L. T. Harrison in the Millennial Star. Quote, "This then is true priesthood, to be images of the living God, exhibiting in our characteristics as brightness in his strength, to be girt and endowed with the purity of his nature, to be unsullied in heart and mind, to stand by the strength of redeeming, saving qualities, to bless and bless and bless again, notwithstanding ingratitude in some, building, sustaining, and protecting all the time, to fight all the spirits and division and all principles of death, to help the weak, the downtrodden, and the helpless, till helping becomes our natural food, working on all principles that yield nourishment, support, and strength, till our very presence is as the sun, cheering and blessing all. So shall God increase within us, refreshing our own spirits and watering all around, and characteristics of the holy priesthood will grow out from us like the branches of a fruitful tree that yields shelter, shield, and fruit." And the quote goes on just a little bit more. "Let a man do this, and he shall be a priest indeed. His authority shall be like a two-edged sword. It shall be confirmed on him for all eternity, for God shall love him and shall bless him. His heart shall increase in richness, and his mind shall grow in strength. No good thing shall be withheld from him. He shall gain and save influence over the hearts of men. He shall be as God among his own, and they shall feel the attributes that live within him till their hearts are stolen from them and linked to him forever. So shall he gain dominion and increase in strength, and really, truly, and eternally be a representative of the Most High God." End of quote. While this remarkable statement describes the priesthood sealing that pertains to a man, it also applies to a woman. They are sealed together and shall be as gods among their own, and they shall feel the attributes that live within them till their hearts are linked to each other forever. So shall they gain dominion and increase in strength and truly become representatives of the Most High. Okay, the last example is Zion. Zion has been used as the name for the mother in heaven who becomes the resurrected mother of spirit children in the next life. This is the final goal after woman's death, And then she has achieved goddesshood. As Tullidge wrote in Women of Mormondom, quote, Joseph Smith was gifted with wonderful memories of the eternity's past. He had not forgotten woman. He knew Eve, and he remembered Zion. And I don't think he's talking about a place there. He restored woman to her place among the gods, where her primeval genesis is written. End of quote. And then another quote from the same book, Women of Mormondom. But where was woman when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy? Where was Zion? Not a place. Where was the bride? Where was the woman? We know from LDS theology that Zion is often called the pure in heart, or the designation of the kingdom of God. To me, however, to Jess, however, Zion is the appropriate name of the mother in heaven. In other words, when a woman has reached the fourth stage, illustrated by Mary Magdalene, she is ready to pass on into the next life. She is ready to become a mother in heaven and to have her own spirit children with her eternal husband. This is the next rotation wherein Zion goes down to an earth along with her husband and becomes an Eve, or mother of all living, for that earth. Together with her husband in the role of Michael, they start the cycle all over again. They become parents to both the spirits and bodies of all men and women who come to that particular earth. Tullidge further emphasizes the position of Zion. Quote, in the temples, both of the heavens and the earth, woman is found. She is there in her character of Eve and in her character of Zion. The one is the type of earth, the other the type of heaven. The one, the mystical name of the mortal, the other, the celestial woman. Man is nowhere where woman is not. Tullidge also continues, quote, henceforth shall the mother half of creation be worshipped with that of the Godfather, and in that worship, woman, by the very association of ideas, shall be exalted in the coming civilization, end quote. Then Tullidge makes this significant statement. The revelation of the father and mother of creation given through the Mormon prophet was set to song by a kindred spirit in the basic idea of the whole Mormon theology. This hymn of invocation, which I read some of the words a few minutes ago, not only treats our God parents in this grand primeval sense, but the poetess Eliza R. Snow weaves around their parental center the divine drama of the preexistence of worlds, and thus the cycle begins again, end quote. So now when we hear the term daughter of Zion, you may want to consider it with an additional meaning. Again from Tullidge, quote, who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners, the daughter of Zion. In summary, we have discussed then the five initiation stages for a Mormon woman who wants to achieve goddesshood. They all are centered around conceptions of love, which at some point involves such things as dying for, living for, and giving up loved ones. Eve lived for her husband and was willing to die for her children. Sarah died for her husband and lived for her children. Mary let go of both husband and son so they could lead their own lives. Mary Magdalene experienced the highest form of marriage and achieved independence. Zion, our mother in heaven, began the cycle all over again. If these archetypal passages for a woman have any relevance, it would be concluded that no eternal marriage in the ultimate sense is achieved unless these stages are accomplished. Hopefully, this plan will help Mormon women in determining the pathway they should follow in order to achieve godhood. So that's signed Jess Grosbeck. I would like to turn some time over now to Toby Pingree. He's on the board of Sunstone, and if you want to tell any more about yourself, Toby, feel free.
I guess we have. I'm on the board of Sunstone. I had access to this paper for a couple of days now, and looked at it and thought about it. I know whence it came, in the sense that Jess Grosbeck and I have been very close friends for over 50 years now. We were missionary companions. And he, and I think some of his predispositions that he's always a remarkable guy, and but he's had some predispositions that I think are come out in paper. They're been there and gone on, and I don't always share all of them, and I'll but you know that you can decide for yourself where you might come out. In the paper, it seems to me that Jess is taking a look at a role that one of the daughters of Eve, or one of the women the world should be following in their lives to reach Godhood, goddesshood. And they, using, talking about Eve and then Sarah and then Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and then finally this Eve, I guess.
Zion.
I call her mother, I mean Zion. I call her mother in heaven. I think that's
that was a new one to me.
Well, Mother in Heaven? isn't that what we're talking about?
Oh, yeah, but the Zion term was...
Well, the Zion term is new to me. I think Mother in Heaven resonates more with what we've been used to thinking about. In each one of the steps in there, he describes in rather glowing terms the things that a woman should do to meet the requirements of that step in order to progress and be eligible for the next level of fulfillment in a woman's life. And the things they seem to have in common are they all involve women making sacrifices, and with little... A little sacrifice by anybody else. There's a little bit of a suggestion the husband has to do some of these things too, and I just don't feel the equity in his approach to this, and I think that's the problem I have with polygamy and a lot of other things is that it's the women that seem to be having to give it up, and if they do and they're faithful in what they do, why they'll be exalted. But it doesn't seem like a man has to do much to do it, and it's not, and isn't it, and children don't have to either in these cases. So the mother gives up something sacrificed for her children. That doesn't come across to me as really the way the Lord would work with things. I think that people, that women and women are, as Anne mentioned, in partnership. And there are, obviously, there's some things that only women can do, particularly the issue of childbearing. That price she's got to pay, and that's a great sacrifice. And the way nature is, she's the only one that can do it. It's got to be done. But that doesn't mean all these other things that she has to give up, subjecting herself to her husband, moving out, living away from him, and she and the other plural wives have to scatter so that their husband can do whatever he does. And she has to sacrifice her relationship to her children when they get to where they need that sort of thing. It just doesn't seem fair. And I think there are suggestions in Mormondom that maybe that's the way it's going to be. I mean, if there's some issues with the temple which would suggest that the woman is supposed to be subjected to things, but. I don't think that with modern women that goes very far, and it really doesn't go very far with me. But I think you can take your pick and decide where you want to go. So,
thanks.
Why
don't you stay up here? I don't know if anyone has any questions. If we can discuss it a little bit, that's fine. Jess isn't here to answer them, but maybe we could help a little bit.
I think we could answer them as Jess would answer them.
Yeah. Any questions? You can come up to the mic or just yell them out, and I'll repeat them. Cherry, did you have a question?
Well, I'm questioning his sources. Tullidge, you know, was a kind of a fringe character in the 19th century. When he put together Women of Mormonism, Eliza R. Snow helped him collect these stories. But so far as I know, the commentary, his kind of glowing exposition of a woman's role, was created out of his own mind and experience. So putting all this 21st century emphasis on Tollage seems to me a little bit suspicious. Your comment.
He was not a member of the church, I don't think, at the time he wrote the book either, but he later joined. But he did have a lot of Mormon principles that he incorporated into the book. And I agree with you, he probably used some glowing terms there. However, a lot of the book consists of blessings that women gave other people as they were crossing the plains. He has a lot of history involved in that book as well. But thank you for your comment. That was good.
Yeah, I was just sharing that I'm not a Queen's book at all, but I think Jess, like most of us,
talk over there in the mic.
It happens to fit with what his model is, and I think so. He's made liberal use of it. Yeah,
Kevin, did you have something?
I was just going to say, in Tollage's book, and I don't think that it was Tollage that was saying this, I think it was actually Lazar Snow. She actually, in chapter XX, she says that there was Eve, and she talks about Eve and some of the roles, and then she talks about Sarah, and then she talks about Zion, the three beginning, the three of this, which was kind of an interesting thing because that was shown to me by a scholar when they were talking about plural marriage in the beginning. Was there a belief that there were other brothers in heaven, or was there a belief that there could have been other wives or other things, which is obviously a controversial thing, but what Jess brought out here is very intriguing because he's talking not just necessarily about them all being plural wives, but that there's aspects of them maybe even changing a phase or a thing as the world progresses. For the world to kind of continue its phase.
That's problematic.
So maybe that was what Eliza was trying to say, was that we're progressing, which is eternal progression.
So. Good, thanks. Did you have a question?
A lot of this is new material for me, so I have lots of questions, but I'm only going to give you a few. The first one was, it seemed that with the second step initiation with Sarah and giving up her husband through polygamy, does it seem that there's any way for us to pass through the stage of initiation without polygamy, without that giving up the husband? So how could we go through his five steps without doing step two?
Well, you're asking the wrong person. I personally believe that those are important steps. And I'm not going to get up here and doctrinally say that you have to do that because that's not the time or the place. But the church, LDS Church teaches that a celestial marriage today is a temple marriage, and maybe if you want to substitute that in there, then go on and don't let it bother you.
But that
right
doesn't
now.
Have the element of sacrifice that's implicit.
Well, I think a woman sacrifices in most marriages. Are you married?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the element of sacrifice is there in most marriages, to some degree or another.
I think what Jeff would say, you're exactly right.
Okay.
Do you have another question?
My second one was, with the idea that women must sacrifice and devote their love to their husband and children, and that's how they are able to progress. You know, in the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard, in his work Sickness and Death, he talks about how you create yourself by centering on something, and the highest one is to center yourself in God, because when you center in God, it's infallible. Yourself will not be destroyed. But the second best is what women tend to do, which is to define themselves by their service to their husbands and their children. However, that's not as good as being transparently resting before God, because they will fail you. They will leave you. So any idea what his response would be to Kierkegaard in that?
The covenant that you make, without divulging any secrecies here, I think somewhere along the line, is a woman should obey her husband as he obeys the Lord. It does not mean that a woman should not have a direct relationship with the Lord in prayer and getting answers to prayer. I think it was Joseph F. Smith said, every tub has to stand on its own bottom, so a woman cannot expect to get any kind of reward in heaven on her husband's coattails. she has to get her own answers, her own testimony, and get there on her own. But there are certain things that must be done as a married couple. I don't know if that answered your question, because I think a woman definitely has to have her own testimony and her own relationship with the Lord.
But you seem to be saying something earlier about the effort she's got to go through her husband. Can you have it both ways?
Well, no, she can respect and obey her husband in righteousness, but she still doesn't pray to him. She prays to God. So she still has a direct relationship with God. I don't see that that's contradictory, is it to you?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I don't see it that way.
As a mother of six children, I think sometimes when you're raising your family, you do give up your husband to a degree because the needs of the children. And sometimes this is difficult for the husband and for the marriage. And also, so I don't think you necessarily have to have a polygamous situations here. And then also, as a woman who's had six children and had very healthy pregnancies, I didn't expect to die. I guess it could happen, and in various societies previous to now, it can happen. But to me, motherhood was a way to live. And so if it was unequal for me to do that, gee, I'm glad I'm a woman. I'm glad I could do that. Because you live through your children, and I think it is a paradigm of an afterlife, and you want to inspire them and give them all the good things. And so I think that's a wonderful thing to go through. And then when you're older and your children leave, then I think you go back, at least I have. Do you have more time for yourself as an individual, particularly if you've raised independent, good children? And so in a sense, even though your children are dead, you know, to you in the sense that they're gone, it's like a rebirth for the woman, and sometimes a rebirth with the husband and wife relationship if you have those closeness and goals. So I think it's really an interesting cycle, but I don't see motherhood as so terribly threatening. Of course, maybe if I was a pioneer woman,
I think in the early days, like in the days of Sarah, so where childbirth was more risky. We didn't have the medical advances that we have now.
Especially if you're 90 years old.
Yeah,
90 was a little risky. But thank you for your comments. That's good. Anything else? Let's see, what time? We're a little early. If there aren't any other comments, then we can go ahead and be dismissed. Thanks a lot for coming.
Good job, Ann.